I'm Mark Kagan and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with AdvantageGo. Release your underwriters to underwrite with AdvantageGo's underwriting platform. Today's guest has quickly shown himself to be one of the industry's most accomplished leaders. When he took over at SiriusPoint just over 18 months ago, he gave the business a tough but clear turnaround plan that he executed quickly. Now just coming through the other side of a remarkable change in fortunes, he's brimming with confidence and ambition to move the business he runs further up the performance percentiles. Scott is a very strong communicator, and the next 40 minutes are packed with very specific ideas, strategies, and clear direction. With someone like Scott, you get the impression that you will always know where you stand and exactly what he expects of you. But the very detailed nature of his responses shows that he also listens extremely carefully to what questions he's asked. SiriusPoint is very much marching to his beat, and he's a very engaging, disarming, and direct podcast guest. Listen on and hear for yourself. Enjoy the podcast. Scott, welcome back to the Voice of Insurance.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It was about a year ago we last spoke, and well, you've done a huge amount since then. So fill us in on what's happened, and also what's the agenda for 2024?
We've been really, really busy, Mark. So that part I can definitely agree with.
I was just doing the research. I was just trying to catch up on all the things that have happened in the last 12 months. And it's a lot.
Yes, it is a lot. And look, I've been very clear when I've spoken externally that a huge gratitude goes to all the people here at SiriusPoint who I think have worked incredibly hard. And I'm afraid outcomes don't happen by accident. They take a huge amount of work. And so I'm really grateful for how hard people have worked here. I'm also grateful to our stakeholders. I think I mentioned this when we last spoke. They've had to be patient with us. And so that includes our brokers, it includes our shareholders, amongst a few. And so I'm really grateful to them for their patience as we've gone through the turnaround. But I think 2023 for us was such an important ending. And really, for me, it marked the end of the turnaround. And that perhaps is a grand phrase. But really, what I'm trying to get at is to say the major surgery, which we had to take from the position in which we started, that major surgery is now over. And I think anyone who looks at our results in 2023 can really see not only the quantum, but also the improvement in the quality. And I think that's a really important measure. And so when we first started the journey, we said we're an underwriting first company. And so the number one metric we will always be judged on is our underwriting performance. And we improved our combined ratios over 10 points year on year. I've tried to manage expectations. It won't be 10 points improvement every year. I promise that much I can be certain about.
We know it can't go to zero.
Well, maybe some people would like that. But truthfully, that's a quantum leap in a year. And that's our number one measure that we always keep coming back to when you're an underwriting first company. But I think the second thing is, if you look at our other sources of earnings from MGAs, from investments, we've had a really, really, really strong year in that regard as well. And all of that has manifested itself in us being ahead of our expectations. So we set some targets on ROE and on cost savings, which we've managed to achieve a year ahead of schedule. And therefore, as part of our end of turnaround, we've reset our guidance for the company beyond 2023. And as you can see from the ROE guidance that we've given, our ambition is to do better. A phrase you'll often hear me say, Mark, is 2023 in itself is not a destination. You know, we have an organization here that we want to keep doing better. And that's the ambition we walk through the door with every single day.
Yes. And in the full year results, you were saying that your ambition now is to be an outperformer.
Yeah, but look, if I had said that right at the beginning, I think everyone would probably have thought I was mad, yeah?
I was a bit, yes, first get up to being a performer rather than
yeah,
a non-performer.
You know, average is a part you have to pass through, right, to get to outperformance. And we were below average at one point in time. And you know, that's perhaps not a nice thing to say, but the truth was the results, the share price, everything showed that we were not performing well. I think in 2023, which marks our fifth consecutive quarter of underwriting profit as well, which I think is important. I think what it does show is that we are back amongst the pack. And the truth is, we don't want to stop there. There is not anyone in this company who wants to be average, starting with me. But wanting and having an ambition to be amongst the best in class in itself means nothing. It comes from hard work, focus, dedication, execution. Those are the things that we're very focused on here at SiriusPoint.
So how are you going to do it? What's the plan? There's lots of things you've said to analysts and journalists probably around your full year results, 23. But let's go into more detail. What's the plan?
Yeah, so Mark, it's a good question. And if you just pick underwriting to begin with, so our underwriting performance, I can sit here and say in 2023, it was 10 points better than the previous year, etc. But there's a lot of people out there who are doing better than us. And so that's a really important sort of reference point for us. So we need to do better. And so for us, the surgical parts of that improvement are over.
I suppose, is it the first phase of doing better is by stopping doing some of the things that really weren't very good, that are obviously not good. And now do you have to move to a phase that's, is it harder to now be really, really good at some new things? Or
to some extent, that's correct. Although I'm going to push back slightly, right? I think just stopping things is not what we've done. We've actually built things as well. But yeah, we had to stop certain things, no question.
It's certainly a feature of remediation is,
of course,
a good thing to do is to stop doing some of the things that are pretty bad.
Listen, if something's hurting you, right, don't keep walking towards it. And so we did have to make some tough decisions. But we've also, really importantly, during 2023, put some infrastructural blocks in place. They're not finished. And there's a journey that we need to go on with them, whether it be our culture, whether it be our IT investment, whether it be our investment in data. These are things that you don't fix in 12, 18 months. These are things that will probably take 3, 4, 5 years to really become the DNA of this organization. So these are the things that we're focused on. But back to your question of, you know, what's your plan? I think we move from what I would term surgical interventions to a phrase I use within the company of, we now need to chase the 1%, because it's that series of incremental improvements in everything that we do, right, that differentiates, in my view, the best in class performers to the average performers. It's having that attention to detail, that grip on the organization, caring about everything, prioritizing well, and then executing like mad, because execution, I'm afraid, is a differentiator in our marketplace, and we aim to be amongst the best in that regard. That's our ambition.
And so we're in a phase more of growth rather than trimming things down. Where's that growth going to come from?
It's probably been our most difficult message, Mark. So when we sit here and we deliver our 23 results and we look ahead to 24, I've had to set a realistic ambition during 2024 for our top line. Why? Because we obviously have an overhang of some of those surgical decisions we've had to take. Those have an overhang, I'm afraid, into 2024.
Well, there's always a lag, isn't there?
Of course. I mean, it's just the simple accounting maths, to be frank. But actually, what we've also announced alongside our results is several areas of growth. We announced 9 new MGAs, for example, that we onboarded during the year, where we signed up new distribution agreements. And so for me, 2024 is a transition year between what I would term the sort of big decisions we had to take, some of them the stops, the building of the growth engines, and 2025 is when we should stand and be accountable for this is the organization that we are. And I would hope, and our ambition certainly is, that we have an organization where the top line is growing. But of course, that makes us stand out at the moment, because many of our competitors are announcing lots of growth in their top line, but they haven't gone on the journey that we've gone on, and they didn't start where we started. So context, I'm afraid, and it's not an excuse, but context is everything.
Where you start from is really, really important, isn't it? You can't do anything about that, and you have to just catch up.
Well, I turn it around the other way. If I'd said 12 months ago we're going to grow 20%, I think people would have run for the trees.
I think your stock price would have gone down 20%.
I think it would have, but life is fickle, right? Life is fickle, and so the truth is we will always be compared to our competitors, and rightly so. I'm not being defensive in any way. We will be compared, but we're on a journey, and we don't judge ourselves by a quarter, by a month, by a year. But ultimately, by 2025, we want to have an organization that is both profitable and performing up there amongst the best in class. That's where we would like to get to. But also that has a top line that is growing. Why? Because if you're doing the right things for your customers, they should want to buy your product. It's really as simple as that. And that's where we want to get to.
And it's a reflection of the quality of this market anyway, that you should be growing in a market that's growing premiums and is growing rate.
Completely agree, and no excuses from me in that regard. If you'd fast forwarded to 25, 26 with the current market conditions, I'm confident we would have grown our top line. Unfortunately, you don't turn around profitability and make 10 points improvement in combined ratio just by not taking tough decisions. And so we've had to take some of those tougher underwriting decisions that you've alluded to. So I sometimes feel that sounds defensive, and maybe it's just my inner voice telling me that, but the truth is that's the journey that we've been on. And I think if you spoke to any of our stakeholders, our shareholders in particular, but also our staff, I think we feel immensely proud by the profit turnaround, and that gives us lots of flexibility to build from as we look to the future.
Sorry to interrupt in mid-flow, but this is just a reminder that you could be advertising right here, right now, and getting your message directly into the ear of key decision makers in the insurance industry. And you'll be doing it while they're absolutely in listening mode. The podcast is the medium of the future, and so is audio advertising. Contact me on mark@thevoiceofinsurance.com, and I'll do everything I can to get you started.
Because of that lag, obviously you've added things and it takes ages for those new things to start producing and to start coming through and start filtering through to the numbers. Have you already sort of done everything that you need to do? You feel that given the teams that you've onboarded and what you've already done, are you already confident that a lot of that growth is already effectively going to be there because you've built it? But of course, it takes 18 months for the premiums to come through.
I don't think you can say that, Mark. I think that would be sort of stretching it somewhat. I think
we can add more.
Yes, is the answer. And so let me give you a great example. London.
Yeah.
I've said, I think when we last spoke, that our London infrastructure is large for the premium that we currently write.
Yes.
But strategically, the London market offers us a fantastic environment to sell our products. It aligns so well with our specialisms, and therefore over time, we want to grow that. I think we're hopefully going to do that in 24. That's our ambition. We've had our stamp increased by Lloyd's, which I think talks to the relationship that we have with the Lloyd's market. But I think that will take more than just 1 year. We're attracting talent to the organisation. You've seen many new names join the company. And so I think that's not just something that we planted all the seeds in the first 6 months, 12 months. I think we will continue to plant them over time.
Yes, in terms of London, when you're analysing London, what do you see as its strengths and weaknesses? It's sort of, you've alluded to one that there seems to be that there's probably a right size for a London operation because of the fixed expense involved in being in London. Would you agree that there probably is a right size for a London operation?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be overly scientific, but if you want to play in that market and have the infrastructure like a managing agent, you want to have your syndicate, etc., then look, I think a degree of scale helps you spread that fixed cost. And certainly that's true for us. I think if we were bigger, we would be more profitable, not because of our underwriting, but because we would be spreading our fixed costs further. And therefore, that's what's behind my comment when I say we would like to grow into our skin to some extent. That doesn't substitute for good underwriting is the number one priority, always, always, always. And so it should not be growth for growth's sake. But look, I think the London market is a market I know well. It's unique. There's nowhere else like it in the world. It's where people come for solutions. It's where complex risks are attracted to find the meeting of buyer and supplier. And therefore, for me, it's a fantastic market for us to operate in. And that was why when I came here, I was very clear. I made some tough decisions about maintaining our presence in the London market. And I'm absolutely delighted that myself and the team did that.
Well, any weaknesses to London, do you think? I mean,
I'm not sure I'd use the phrase weaknesses. I would say, are there things that they need to concentrate on? Yes, of course, it's a market and a business like anything else. And so for me, if you don't pay attention to the world around you and you slightly fall asleep, then guess what? You get overtaken. And I think the Lloyd's market is an example of that as well. And so whether it be focusing on AI, whether it be focusing on data, whether it be focusing on automation, I'm afraid the market in itself has to focus on those things as well. Otherwise, people will find other places and other solutions might pop up, and that could be a threat. So I don't think it's a weakness per se, but I think we all have to think of the market through those types of lenses, just to give some examples.
It seems to be that we're at a time where there's some technological transformations finally coming to London, and certainly, you know, we've got some big switch offs and switch overs. I really don't want to call it Big Bang because I'll probably get in trouble up on the 12th floor of Lloyd's, but it's the sort of thing that journalists might call a Big Bang. Do you think that we're going in the right direction?
Yes, I do. Completely do. And that's why I'm saying I think we've all got a part to play in helping support in that transition. I'm fully supportive of the direction that the market is taking. And I won't use that phrase, but I do think I'm happy with the ambition and the pace that I'm seeing, and I'm fully supportive, and we'll play whatever part we can to help shape the future of the market.
And you get the benefits of it.
100%.
If you make it work.
100%. And it's a market we want to exist today, tomorrow, and in the future.
What about the capital question? So with growth, do you need more capital to do that? Obviously, in London, there's so many different capital solutions available to you these days that weren't necessarily always there back in the old days.
Well, the great news is, Mark, when we published our full year results for 2023, our capital ratios are actually really, really strong. And I think probably stronger than most people had anticipated. And so the great news is, as we sit here today, as a fact, our capital ratios are strong. If you fast forward, I think they will get stronger. That's certainly the path that we're on, both from our organic capital generation, but also other things that we're doing. And therefore, the capital strength of this organisation, I think, without repeating myself, is going to be a strength. And I think never underestimate how important that is when a customer needs you to be there tomorrow to pay their claims. And so we're not capital constrained, and therefore for our growth ambitions, we have plenty of capital to support our ambition, but we also have capital as well to support the investments that we want to make and take in the business.
And that's most business because it's retained earnings and just you generating your own. So
yeah, correct. I mean, look, we've done a number of structural things as well. We've talked before about
cost expense.
We've done cost out, we've done MGA disposals, we've done an LPT, if you remember, I think
on our
last call we talked about that. These are the more structural aspects that have helped our capital. But of course, the number one priority always will be organic capital generation from both our underwriting business, our MGA, consolidated MGAs, and also our investments.
Oh, and just a quick abbreviation buster would be LPT is a loss portfolio
transfer.
A legacy deal, as we might just call it in the press.
Much, much better. Much better. We get caught in jargon land here in insurance.
Back years deal to free up capital, etc. The market's changed a huge amount, and obviously you've changed a lot in that time as well. You're in insurance, you're in reinsurance, and you're in fee-generating businesses. You've got equity stakes in different MGAs and things. But we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later on. But the market dynamics are always changing, and obviously you have capital, and you want to allocate that capital to where it's going to get the best returns over time. Obviously, we've had a much better reinsurance market than we had before. Obviously, the insurance market has been improving for quite a long time. And now, obviously, like there are many mini cycles going on within different classes within insurance, as we know that some still have been softening for a couple of years already. How has that changed your calculus of what an ideal balance is with SiriusPoint? Or do you just allow it to say, well, it'll change its balance naturally on its own? Because if reinsurance is good, then reinsurance is obviously clearly going to grow as a percentage of what we do just because on rate alone.
All of that is probably a bit true, but let me try and...
Because even if you do nothing, it'll still change.
Correct. So let me... I'm not being flippant when I say probably everything you said there is truthful, but let me start strategically to begin with, because I think that's at the heart of the question that you're asking me. So
yeah,
I think,
do you have an ideal, and has that changed because the market's changed?
Look, I would say not necessarily linked to the market, but I've gone on record as saying that we want to grow insurance proportionately more than reinsurance. I've gone on record as saying that. I sometimes get slightly frustrated because people take that as we're shrinking reinsurance. That is not true.
Is it could just grow at a relatively lower rate?
Correct. Thank goodness, Mark. You know, that's exactly
exactly
the quote.
Basic maths, yes.
Yeah, that's the quote. But it's and I understand why people have taken that view, because obviously one of the surgical decisions we had to take was in the reinsurance market. If you remember, in the last quarter of 2022, when we exited Property Cat International. So without being flippant for a second, I do know why people take that phrase and sort of extrapolate it forward. But it's not true. We are completely committed to the reinsurance market, but we proportionately want to grow insurance over reinsurance. If we sit here today, we're probably, without being spuriously accurate, 65% insurance, 35% reinsurance. And I would say, you know, might that grow a little? Yes. Is it going to sort of fling wildly one way or the other? Not particularly. And I haven't given an exact number as to what we're aiming for, because honestly, I'm not quite sure you can ever be that purist on these things. But your second point, which you alluded to in there, is will that move around at different points in time, depending on market conditions? 100%. So if I stood up here tomorrow and said we are 60% insurance, 40% reinsurance, would I have beads of sweat on my brow because somehow I had shifted the dial? No, as long as the economics are right. And the last part of the question, which I think is really, really important, and for us as an organisation, a really important part of our culture, is that we have an agility between insurance and reinsurance. So we will sometimes access markets in different ways, depending on the economics and depending on the solutions that customers want. And for us, that's one of the reasons customers come to SiriusPoint. And that part of our DNA is so, so, so important. So I think broadly, big mix. I think I'm not uncomfortable. We'll probably grow insurance a little more. Any quarter, any year, could it move around? Yes, and I make no apologies for that.
Because sometimes you just can't access business via insurance. You've got to access it via
Link it to your last question, Mark. I've got capital. If I can see an opportunity, for example, in the reinsurance market where I can deploy capital, it aligns with our capabilities, we can do great solutions for customers, we can make good economic returns, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to deploy it, because that way I can make more money for shareholders, and that at the end of the day is what we're here for. But what I will not do is deploy money recklessly.
I don't want to put words in my mouth, but so where are those better opportunities? It sounds like they're probably in insurance at the moment.
I don't think that's true, actually. And again, one of the things that I've commented on going through the results season is there's a sort of mild obsession about property cat and the rates. And all of a sudden people say, we're not getting the same rates as we did last year. Well, I really hope not, because it was a market correction last year. But what we are seeing and what we've seen is we have carried rate. Obviously not the same rate as the year before. So we are still seeing, for example, in reinsurance, attractive markets. That doesn't mean to say every single case is attractive, but we do see market conditions generally as being attractive. And I think if we stood back and just used our 1-1 renewals as an example, covering both insurance and reinsurance, we would say that we carried rate in line, maybe even slightly ahead of our expectations. And therefore that talks to a set of markets, both in insurance and reinsurance, that we think are attractive, that align well with our specialisms, and we think we can deploy capital well.
And certainly as a buyer, I presume that at least it was much calmer and it was much easier to know what you were going to get for what you were going to spend.
Well, we had a slightly different situation, actually, if I'm being really honest with you. So one of the things we disclosed at our full year results was our retro purchase, which is what you're alluding to, where we jumped to the other end of the telescope and look back. And actually, we purchased for the same amount of money, more capacity, lower limits. And for us, that was a big proof point back to our context and our journey again. That was a really big proof point where
was that lower attachment points?
Lower attachment points, yeah. So effectively, that was a real statement from the market to say, we believe in the underwriting journey that you're on, because effectively we've used our money to buy better cover.
And certainly I'd say retro probably is the ultimate underwriting market where the underwriter is really underwriting the underwriter. You're right to say that is a statement of greater credibility in what you're doing.
But that's true for us as well, Mark. Yeah. So when we work with MGAs, which is obviously a core part of our strategy, a big part of what we look for is those quality underwriters, the relationships, the data, etc. So I think that statement actually covers more than just the retro.
I suppose retro is just compounded because you're an underwriter who underwrites underwriters who underwrite underwriters who underwrite underwriters. So, and that's
I'm not going to repeat that. Yeah,
yeah, I'm going to get everyone to try and say that.
I'm not going to repeat it, but what I can tell you is people have looked at our results, seen the progress that we've made, and actually, more importantly, they don't just get seduced by the number. They obviously look below that number, they dissect it, and that's my comment about the quality of our earnings. I think what people are seeing now at SiriusPoint is the improvement in the quality of our earnings and really the track record that we're beginning to build. And that is what people are seeing very, very strongly.
So there's less uncertainty in the mind of a retro underwriter than there would have been.
Correct. I would say. Correct.
Another big part of your changes that you've made in strategy since joining, and we discussed this last year, but I mean, obviously I'm a media person, so I know that sometimes you have to discuss them almost ad infinitum before people actually notice that you're doing it or before they stop misunderstanding what you're doing. In your annual results, you disclosed that you'd rationalised and you'd got some of the capital back, and some of these must have been successful investments, which are good and nice source of new capital. You're down from 36 equity investments in MGAs to 25. Where's that going to tend to? Is it going to tend to zero? Because obviously then people extrapolate, like in the way that they extrapolated you moving out of property cat into you not doing any reinsurance at all. How should we read it? Should we say that one day you won't have any equity stakes in any MGAs? But then you've also just said that, of course, you've got relationships with MGAs and you've just added about, what was it, 9, I think you just said.
Yeah. So let's go back a stage strategically. Number one, the reason that we made the strategic decision, which is to have less equity investments in MGAs, is because as an organization, to manage 36 investments is a lot, and it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy.
It's a lot of board meetings.
It is a lot of board meetings, but it ties up a lot of our organization. If you go back to my first strategic statement, which is we're an underwriting company, do we really need to have equity investments to have a successful underwriting company? The answer to that is no. We have got hundreds of distribution relationships with MGAs, and those are obviously different to the equity relationships. So therefore, we went on this journey of saying, look, it's just a lot of work and we can't manage that many different equity investments. And so we've been shrinking them. And I think at the beginning, people might have thought there was a capital problem and therefore we had to sell them really quickly. And I've used the phraseology almost, you know, was it a fire sale? I think we've managed to push that to one side and say, no, right, it's not, and go back to my earlier sort of comments on capital. So what we're doing is we're just working this through thoughtfully and carefully, finding the right buyers for all of our equity investments. Lots of times that's the existing management teams of the MGAs, but I think over time, I'm not going to answer the question on exact number, but what I would say to you is that we will have significantly less. I am not uncomfortable with having some. And so as an example, if I use an example, we have a 100% ownership of IMG, which is an MGA that's tied to our accident and health business. You know, fantastic, grown really well during 2023, incredibly happy owner of that MGA. So I think unlikely ever to be zero, but will be significantly less than the 25 that
we have. Sensible. There's no point telling everyone you're a seller because they're just going to chisel you down on the price.
But the two things I've never commented on are the names, because it would be hugely disrespectful to do that.
No, you don't want to be working at a place that where one of your major shareholders I'm going to sell.
I would never do that, and I've never given the quantum. And I think all we try and do every quarter is we just give a factual update, which is really the progress against our strategy. And obviously, I've explained the logic to you of why we're doing that.
And of course, carriers often end up buying MGAs because they make a ton of sense, and sometimes they develop to a point where it makes a huge amount of strategic sense to then bring them on board.
Yeah, and I think, look, for us, I would never say we would never buy another MGA or take an investment in another MGA. But what I will say is that we won't have 36.
So it's not your modus operandi anymore, and anyway. So it's not part of what was part of the story.
It's not, but what we have got is fantastic distribution relationships. In fact, of the 11 that we've exited, I can't remember the exact number, but I would say around 2/3, we've actually signed long-term distribution agreements. So actually they see us as a valuable partner going forward on the distribution side, regardless of whether you're an equity owner or not. And I think that really vindicates the strategic direction that we're going in. And you referenced it earlier on, but just to keep providing that clarity, we've also brought on 9 new distribution relationships, not equity investments, distribution relationships. And so MGAs are a critical part of our strategy, but we don't need to have equity stakes.
Yeah, and what about that hybrid model that has really grown enormously? Does that hold any appeal? And because it's capital light, the idea of being more of a fronting carrier for some of these MGAs, does that appeal at all? Or is it something?
Not really. No. Not for us. And the reason is our DNA, if you go back to my comment, is we're an underwriting company. Yeah. And therefore, I want people to come to us not to rent our balance sheet per se, but because we actually bring underwriting expertise to the table. And so that's where our strategic focus is.
And so backing those MGAs is where you can see some underwriting talent that, well, you ideally wish they were working for you, but they're not available, or they're doing something special, or, you know, they've got their own ambition and some people just don't want to work for a carrier, I suppose. It's just the way it is.
I'm not sure I quite agree with exactly that phraseology.
Is it because there's some talent that just won't work for a carrier?
Well, I think
some underwriting talent.
What we look for when we partner with an MGA is a partnership. And so that phraseology is really good. There are things we bring to the table. We bring a lot of portfolio information, data, richness. They can bring some front-end customer relationships, front-end trading underwriters. But the truth is, what we're looking for in all of our MGAs is that partnership where we each bring something to the table, and it's that outcome that ends up in A, good outcomes for customers and good performance. And we're very, very, very selective, Mark, about who we'll partner with. And I don't want that to sound like I'm being judgmental, because the same is true the other way. But we very rarely ever work with an MGA that we haven't gotten to know over a long period of time, we built up a relationship with. We don't step into these relationships easily. And actually, one of the things when we do step into those relationships is we've just created a new center of excellence for onboarding MGAs. That sounds very grand. What does it mean? It means that we want to bring the two companies together in a really thoughtful, joined up way, whether it be on data, whether it be on oversight, whether it be on governance, whether it be on day-to-day trading. And if you do that really well, then actually you feel as one. And that for me is a raw ingredient of success in that type of relationship.
That's interesting, because actually we talk about paper and it sounds quite dismissive when you just say paper as an MGA. And it's nice that you're saying actually you want MGAs that really value some of the things that you can bring, i.e. you know, wider data on that class of business, for example.
Correct. But you both have to work at that. Doesn't just
happen. Yeah, you have to try and have a relationship.
Correct. Which is why the onboarding aspect of it is really, really, really important. So there's a relationship, there's a human part to it. Of course there is. Yeah. You have to have a chemistry, you have to go on, you have to respect what each other bring. But then there's a sort of, dare I say, infrastructural, mechanical part to it, Mark, where actually making sure that you bring people on, you build the data pipes to make sure that you're sharing information, and that's both ways, that you create a sort of oversight model around it where you have the opportunity to review performance, bring portfolio information, discuss, debate, agree. That all doesn't happen by accident. And if you can get that right, that's where the secret sauce is.
In terms of that opportunity in insurance, we've had this really big shift in the US market from admitted lines to excess and surplus lines. So I moved to wholesale from commercial retail, should we say. Are there any signs of that big shift changing or slowing down? Because in the past, it's been very cyclical.
No, I think it's a long-term trend, would be my view. I think as customers get more sophisticated and the risks get more complicated, I think it's a long-term trend. I think at any point in time, you can have what I would call movements between, right? But I still think the trend is in the direction you've just articulated. So we need to make sure as an organization that we're thinking long term in that regard and making sure that we're setting the organization up to take advantage of that.
Is that because just risks are getting more sophisticated, and also the perils seem to be more sophisticated? We'd say property was the risk of the 19th century and it's become very static and quite boring. And of course, suddenly it seems to have got not boring at all, because the risks that affect property have suddenly become more dynamic.
I agree.
Storms and floods and wildfires, things that we didn't really have to worry about before, suddenly they've become so dynamic. And that, you know, a building just sitting somewhere, we thought we'd probably worked that out, and now it turns out we haven't.
That's my point. I think the long-term trends are customers want better solutions because their risks are ever evolving, more complicated, changing. And that's why I think that's a long-term trend. As I say, at any point in time, I think you can convince yourself it's not, and you can move around. But I think if you look at the data now over a period of time, you can see that it's a trend, and that trend, I think, will continue.
It's hard to underwrite that in an environment where you have to file your rates and forms for 12 months and stick with them and kind of, you know.
I think that in the future won't exist, honestly, in my view, because I think the world is a much more dynamic place. And not just the world's more dynamic, but I think we've got much more opportunity on a real-time basis to use data to help us really improve the underwriting sophistication and improve the outcomes for the customer. And therefore, doing something that's so static, I think it doesn't matter what industry you're in, I think that type of approach to the world that we live in today is probably on a long-term basis going away.
Big thing we've been debating, certainly in the last 12 months, but we're always debating it because it's the nature of this class of business of casualties, that it's bound to be debatable because it's got the most uncertainty attached to it because it's the longest tail. Where are you standing? I mean, you know, we're debating casualty in general and US casualty in particular. Where's SiriusPoint standing in this part of the
debate? It's definitely one of the most debated topics through the 23 results. Look, I think if we stand back, we obviously participate heavily in the casualty markets and we're happy to do that. So there's no risk appetite issue in that space. But I think like everyone else, we're thoughtful about the long-term trends, about the inflationary pressures. And so we do spend a lot of time analyzing the trends, analyzing the data. That does not make us unique, but we obsess about it in the same way that I'm sure many of my colleagues and my competitors do as well. But if you stand outside of this, for us, we take a very prudent approach to our reserving. That doesn't mean to say we get it right all the time, and that's, of course, life is not like that. But we start in a place where we tend to err on the side of caution. And I make no apologies about that. I explain it that way to our investors, to our board, to everyone. And therefore, what that should mean is that we have less issues over time. Now, that coupled with making sure that you're looking ahead, making sure that you're understanding trends, making sure that your rates are keeping up with it, these are really, really, really important dynamics in the casualty classes. And so the big talking points were some of the older years on casualty. And then there's a secondary topic that's come out of that, which is, are you only worrying about the older years because the younger years haven't developed yet? And the answer might be they may follow that same trend. But if you look at the rating environment over that period, you would say that actually higher rates have been carried, et cetera, et cetera. So look, for Sirius Point, I don't think we sit here with real concern, but there's also no complacency. We do keep looking at the trends, and we do want to make sure that our pricing keeps pace with those trends, and our reserving will always err on the side of
prudence. So you sound fairly neutral.
The word I honestly would like to use is we're not complacent. Every single quarter, I promise you, we obsess about it in the same way that everyone else does, but I don't feel sitting here that we've got a problem.
Well, I'm glad. Yes, I think that there's no room for complacency ever in anything to do with casualty.
No, never. I agree with that. That's one thing we can definitely agree on.
Absolutely. We were talking about technology and data, and we were trying not to call it Big Bang, but what I was saying, some of the technological changes that are coming to the wholesale global specialty and reinsurance markets, which are really interesting. What do you think the long-term consequences of these are going to be? And it's certainly, you just said earlier that this is a 4 or 5 year thing for you. So obviously it's something you thought deeply about in a strategic plan. Year five, year six, where do you think we might be if everything goes really well?
Look, it's such a big topic. And sitting here today, I don't think we know some of the data trends that are coming through. And one of the slight worries I have about our industry, our sector, is that we occasionally slap ourselves on the back thinking we've had an innovation that another industry and sector has been using for a decade. Look at the retail sector and the data that they have and what they've done to analyse customers and behaviours and habits. So one of the things that I worry about, not about Sirius Point, I'm talking about the industry in general, is are we really keeping pace with the data trends and the ability to use that data, analyze it, and risk price with it? I think we have to keep pushing ourselves, and certainly within Sirius Point, we're trying to do that. I think the second thing for me, which is again an industry problem in a way, is it's not so much getting the data, it's just the quantum of it and how you analyze it and how you pull through trend and then how you then price using that data. That's hard. And I think as an industry, I'm not sure we've really worked out how to use just the quantum of information that we can have and distill it into what I would call information that really helps us risk price. I think we're always looking for the next data source or the next. There's so much data now, Mark. And I think that's the bigger problem, is which is how do you take it and sort of distill it and then pull out the insight and then price? And I think we're all slightly searching for that golden thread.
That's going to make a market because people are going to come out with different answers, aren't they?
Yeah, 100%. But I think the common problem we all have is how do you take the amount of information that really is available to us? Now, I mean, look at where we are today versus two decades ago. We could never have dreamed of having the sort of information that we have available. You can purchase it, you can buy it, you can get it online. But what really does make a difference for analysing risk A, risk B, risk C. That's the part that I think we as an industry are really pushing ourselves to understand more fully.
This is that sort of underwriting skill. What about on friction in terms of distribution, having APIs through to brokers, that kind of thing where you're almost sort of doing some sort of Vulcan mind meld. I don't know.
That sounds very grand.
It makes me sound like a real Trekkie, but it's sort of that kind of thing where brokers are very, very seamlessly placing business with you and you're bidding on what they've got in front of you. And how far could that be automated as well?
Well, I think you raise a really important point here, which is the use of automation, data, etc., to streamline processes and make you more efficient and effective. And it's not just one or the other, it's both. No excuses. We work in an industry where on average, the margin is 5 to 10%. We're not working in an industry where we've got 50% margins. Therefore, go back to my earlier phrase that I use within Sirius Point. keep chasing the 1%, because the 1% matter. And therefore, we cannot be complacent as an industry, whether that be the Lloyd's market that we talked about earlier on, whether it be individual companies. We have to keep going after ways to use technology to help us be more effective and efficient. That said, I think there is a real skill in underwriting. And therefore, that part, that deep specialist knowledge that people have to deeply understand a customer's requirements, a customer's risks, and then actually take them and price them, I think that part of it at the front end is super, super important, particularly in a lot of the more specialized lines. I think if you're in personal motor, then it's a different sort of underwriting skill. But there can be no excuses in the value chain, if you like, in going after efficiency and effectiveness.
And so things like AI, would you see them far more as a productivity tool, something that's going to help ingest a lot of information, put it in the right format and help price it and help that underwriter do more and do it better? And therefore, you know, obviously, just by definition, improve their expense ratio because they're able to be perhaps, I don't know, twice as productive.
I don't see it, because I think you're slightly blending things there when you ask that question, which is you're describing both efficiency and effectiveness.
Yes.
Right. So do I think that we can use AI to help make parts of the process more efficient? 100% I think we can, and we need to keep pushing ourselves, was my point earlier
on. Just
some
of the basics. But do I think we don't do that, so to send that away.
I think stuff can be done in the process chain, and I think that's true in every industry in the world. The part that you then started to share is the ability to give information quickly in a really user-friendly way, if you like, to our underwriters to help them make better underwriting decisions. That's the effectiveness part. That part for me is where the juice is.
Okay, and that's where the jury's out as well.
Maybe, because it's hard. It goes back to what I said earlier on. It's that how do you take everything you pour in the hopper and bring it all the way down to a particular risk and make it relevant to that risk evaluation? That's the part that's hard, because it is hard. But that's the part that if you get it right, and deliver that information to the underwriter in a way that helps them evaluate that risk, that's where the magic will happen.
Sounds like a JFK speech or something. I'm trying to remember. I'll misquote it, you know, but we don't go there because it's easy. We go there because it's hard to do and it's worth doing.
Well, listen, it's better than your Vulcan phrase, right?
From a similar era, all this stuff is dating me.
Star Trek versus JFK.
Dating me quite a lot. So SiriusPoint's quite a small entity within this great ferment of the market. Is it of a scale that you can guarantee independence? There are lots of small entities that seem to be fine, but they tend to be defined by a particular niche or something.
It's interesting, Matt, because if I go back in my career before SiriusPoint, I've worked for large organizations, I've worked for smaller ones. The truth is, if you do any sort of evaluation of companies in our sector across the marketplace over two decades, you will see categorically that small to medium-sized companies perform better. And therefore, if it was just as simple as scale delivers better returns, I'm afraid that statement I've just made would not stack up. And therefore, that's why some of the attributes that are really important to our culture, like agility, like collaboration, these things that are really important, I think those are really, really, really differentiators and getting to what I would term that best-in-class level. So is scale important? I think you have to have enough scale. So we're 3 to 4 billion premium. I think that gives us enough scale. If you break it down into component parts, we had a conversation about our London book in isolation. I think we need to be larger in that particular market. So I think there's always parts of it where you can. But at a macro level, I would take small to medium size, perfectly formed, you know, high performing ROE for our shareholders every single time, because I think the Goliaths over many decades have not performed at the same levels.
You reminded me of there was a really good study by the Insurance Insider of all the syndicates and Lloyd's, because obviously you get decent data on that, and they do those kind of quadrant analysis. They did a correlation sort of exercise of size and performance, and they couldn't really see any. There were loads of small ones that were doing great, loads of big ones weren't doing great, loads of big ones that were doing great, and small ones that weren't doing great. And there was no real correlation. So we'll have to take issue on your small and mediums better. I don't know if it is.
Well, I was talking about more.
But there are
not
some
just, not
better
just Lloyd's. I was more talking about the insurance industry.
That's
in
the
general.
Only thing I've got data for, but obviously it's a reasonably large sample.
Yeah. So look, I think, however, we can both violently agree that there isn't a definitive case to be made for scale means you're better. And as I say, I think my rationale for that is really straightforward, which is just having scale and therefore the efficiency benefits, if you like, of having scale don't overcome, I think, many more important ingredients like attitude, execution, lucky bureaucracy, etc., etc. That is really the point I'm trying to make.
No, there's a good point. Skill beats scale any day.
A much better way of saying it.
You were talking about hiring, and I suppose we're in a situation where you're looking to hire people, and we're always talking about how it's difficult to find talent. What's your pitch when you're out there trying to hire top people?
Well, look, let's go back a stage. When I first came here, and because of the context, again, of this organisation, we found it difficult to attract people, to Sirius' point. That's a difficult part of the journey because you want to affect change, but people are apprehensive about joining the organisation. I fast forward now 18 months, and if I look at the last 6 months here, and I think you can read in the press, all of a sudden, people are wanting to be part of this journey. It's one of the things I'm most proud of, Mark, that actually we're attracting talent again to the company. And that's building on the existing talent that we have here within Sirius Point and complementing it with new and fresh ideas and people. And I think that's a really important component of any successful company. And so when I'm out there talking to people, this is a company who has an ambition, number one. Number two, a company that people can start to see is transforming itself from underperformer to, let's agree, middle of the pack now, but with an ambition. That can be quite exciting for people. Three, it's a company that respects and wants people to bring deep specialisms to work, where we can really take that to the customer, really deeply, deeply, deeply understand their risk and deploy those solutions. And then I think the fourth part of it is our culture and what we stand for here and how we work and how we value our people. And actually, that's a big part of what people feel every single day when they come to the office. Am I valued? Am I respected? Do I have a voice? What does it feel like to work here? I think if you can get those three or four things over and you can hear the passion in my voice starting to come through, I think it's a place that people want to come and work. And that's been our experience over particularly the last 6 months.
Well, certainly, I'm sure we can pick up some of the noise of the bustling corridor that
now
going
can,
past.
Can, it's like a bus stop, yeah.
Lots
yeah.
of happy people running past, so yes.
Look, I think there's a lot of beginning again to have pride in the organisation. This is a really important part. People want to come to work and feel proud of who they work for and what they do. And I think, truthfully, in its past, that's been quite hard when the company is underperforming. I think there's a real sense of pride that Sirius Point is back. And that is exactly how I feel. It's how I feel in my gut. And it's how people feel here every day. And there's a steely, steely determination in everyone's eyes. The chins are out. And we are absolutely determined to fulfill that ambition.
Well, Scott, I think anyone listening to this can hear some of that steely determination in your voice. So I really appreciate you coming on the show again. And let's book a date some point in the future because things are moving so fast.
Super, Mark. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this program. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry.
The Voice of Insurance is produced in association with Advantage Go. Release your underwriters to underwrite with Advantage Go's underwriting platform.
Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.